Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlotta Lomas in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on today's show, we're getting eco-freaky. That's right, we're talking all about green living. But what does it mean to live sustainably? Is it enough to simply separate our trash from the recycling? Or to switch to energy-saving light bulbs and turn off appliances when we're not using them? Well, today we head into the domestic sphere to find out what some people are doing to reduce their own carbon footprint. And we find out just how hard it is. Stay tuned. Fading skin and frosted eyes. You're cold, but it's cool, but you're boiling inside. How often do we stop? Like, really stop, to consider the materials used to package our everyday produce? Here in Germany, when we shop at the supermarket, so much of what we buy comes wrapped in some sort of plastic. I mean, there's fruit and vegetables like cucumbers and zucchinis that come individually wrapped in the stuff. Then there's milk, yogurt, cheese, shampoo, toothpaste. We live in a plastic world. And it's not just the production of plastic that's unsustainable. A lot of it also ends up polluting the environment and swirling around in our oceans. But giving up plastic is no easy thing to do and can involve some pretty drastic changes to the way we shop and think about waste. So what do you do? Our reporter Natalie Muller asked some people here on the windy banks of the Rhine in Bonn about what effort they make to reduce their own plastic waste.
When I go to the shops, I bring my own bags and I refuse to take bags at bookstores or stuff like that where they offer you bags. So if I can help it, I don't take a bag.
So I'm also taking my own bag to the shop, and there's some products I only buy without plastic. For example, that I buy my fruits and vegetables from the market and not from the supermarket where it's packed in plastic.
I probably overuse plastic. I think I buy sandwiches, I buy disposable cups, forks, knives, cutlery. I probably overuse very, very badly.
And is that something you would like to change at all?
To be honest, I haven't thought about it.
Well, actually, I try by average shopping. I try to reduce the amount of plastic that I carry when I leave the shop. But it's quite difficult because most things you only get packed. You can't just choose them and put them in a bag that you bring yourself or a paper bag instead.
I get annoyed sometimes at the packaging. For example, if you buy razors or razor blades, there's just so much plastic. It's ridiculous and it doesn't seem necessary. Is there any food or other products that you won't buy because of how much plastic is involved in the packaging?
Yes. When I buy, for example, a jar of tomato, concentrated tomato, I prefer to buy it in glass.
And do you think you could live without plastic?
No, it's impossible because it has its benefits and its negatives as well.
I think in everyday life, what you need for living, such as food or clothes or whatever, you could actually live without plastic, yes. And I think it's very important that we get a recycling system where what we have to use of plastic material, where you can't find any alternatives, that it should at least be recycled responsibly.
Could you live without plastic?
I think so. I mean, it would require some planning and some forethought, but why not?
I don't know. It seems like a lot of work, and a lot of the things I really like come in their own plastic packaging, so no.
We don't really realize how much plastic is being used in everyday life, and I'm sure we can reduce it by a fair amount, but to completely not use it anymore would be pretty tough, I think.
Okay, so not everyone seems willing, but really, just how difficult would it be to live without plastic? Well, Tamsin Walker recently took up the challenge. For 2 months, she altered her life so as not to generate any plastic waste. She shopped for her family on a no-plastic basis, trying to spend no more time or money than she would on a regular grocery run. And as Tamsin discovered in Berlin, it was no easy feat to be plastic-free.
This is the sound of my experiment getting underway. Back in January, I decided to banish plastic wrappings from my life. I wanted to find out how feasible it would be, as a working, single mother of several, to buy everything I needed for cooking, cleaning, and personal hygiene, either loose or packaged in paper, glass, or aluminium. So, where to begin? My kitchen and bathroom cupboards. To be clear about exactly what I had in stock, I emptied everything from rice to shampoo to washing up liquid into glass jars. It was oddly nerve-wracking to see low stocks of everyday products on display, as I knew that replenishing them would require more than a trip to the supermarket. It implied inventive solutions. And if I were to meet my self-imposed challenge of spending no more time or money on this new lifestyle, it also meant shopping locally. And therein lay the first problem. Most staples, such as rice, grains, and cereals, come in plastic bags, and the only place to get them loose in Berlin is the unpackaged food store at the other side of the city.
How many staples, Mummy? Oh, just a few.
Since I don't have a car, it's a round trip of an hour and a half. Not ideal, but I reasoned that if I went there just once a month, I could stock up on the essentials and get the day-to-day stuff closer to home. And besides, the unpackaged food store is a more interactive shopping experience for the very young.
Hold it there.
No, you hold it.
You hold. Wait a second, not too many.
The idea is that you take your own containers, be they boxes, bags, or bottles, weigh them, then fill them up with whatever you need from the dispensers along the walls. It's a beautifully simple concept, but beware small and enthusiastic hands, which can be a financial liability, as my almond and muesli bills went to show.
Oh, enough. We've got a lot of nuts now.
I think that's enough.
So, gee, what else do we need?
But as good as the shop is, it was clearly not going to be an everyday solution for me. What I needed was a network of places near a home where I could reliably get fruit, cheese, vegetables, meat, and fish. In the early days of the experiment, I thought I could import it, at least in part, into my supermarket. Today did not feel like a victory for the zero waste efforts of this family. Actually, I felt very much like an outsider. What you're asking for is for them not to put a piece of plastic around a block of cheese. And they look at you as if you're A, insane, B, asking for something utterly unreasonable. That left the market, which is close to home and open 4 days a week. And if I'm quick enough, I can do a bit of shopping between the school run and getting to work.
Right, I'm going to get some apples, putting them straight into my basket so I don't have to bother with any kind of plastic bag, which are hanging here. I'm going to get some carrots. Now I'm going to go and see if they'll put the whole lot directly into my bag for me.
And he did. Likewise, the fishmonger and the butcher are happy to put my purchases straight into a box I take with me. Though it's a little bit awkward when you forget, as I have done now on more than one occasion, to take the lid. I have had to get very inventive with a winter hat. So I now have our food needs covered and rarely have to go to a supermarket, which is a liberty in itself. But what about all the hygiene products? Starting with toilet paper, which is almost always wrapped in plastic. After a long internet trawl, I found a shop in Munich that sells it in a box. Having it delivered from 600 kilometres away is dubious, I admit. But in the interest of this experiment, I ordered some. And 2 days later... Today I got a delivery, and I am assuming that it is my 24 rolls of toilet paper. And it is indeed not wrapped in any plastic whatsoever. That still left things like shampoo, conditioner, moisturiser, floor cleaner, shower gel, and toothpaste. Having bought a job lot of bamboo toothbrushes, we needed something to put on them. So I went to a shop that sells tooth tabs in returnable bottles. They let you try before you buy.
I like it. Can we have one more try?
It was a short-lived passion, and the half-empty jar of tabs now sits sadly redundant on our bathroom shelf. Next up, we tried making our own from coconut oil, baking soda, and peppermint oil. How did that go down?
Not bad.
Well, like the salty water when we go swimming.
I think it tastes a little bit around your mouth here.
Why did you put the disgusting things in it?
You can't say we didn't try. Ultimately, we compromised on metal tubes with plastic tops, which, like all our sins, get stuffed into an empty yogurt jar so we can see exactly how much waste we're creating. We've since worked our way through the remainder of the toiletries list, swapping shower gel for soap and liquid shampoo and conditioner for the solid variety. We make our own body and lip balm using cocoa butter and beeswax, sourced in paper, which, I might add, was not easy to get hold of. Because the fact is, we do live on a plastic planet. It's so ubiquitous that I have, and this is somewhat embarrassing to admit, bought things wrapped in plastic without even realising until I got home. And given that space is tight in our yoghurt jar, I've started to upcycle. Most of the plastic that came to me inadvertently, along with any bags that predated this experiment, has been turned into reusable sandwich wrappers. The kids have them, as do probably more of my family members than really want them. But using this disposable material to create something that looks nice and has a longer life has opened my eyes to the idea of plastic as a resource rather than just something destined for the trash. And I like that. And it's not all I like. There's also the welcome relief from choice paralysis and knock-on effect of less clutter and a healthier diet. But is it a sustainable way of life? I'd say it is. In more ways than one.
That was Tamsin Walker in Berlin. And if you'd like to let us know what you're doing to reduce your plastic waste, you can tweet us at DW_eco or email us at livingplanet@dw.com. In Denver, in the US state of Colorado, a newly built eco-friendly housing community is proving that green infrastructure can be cost-effective. Mariposa District, which was partially funded by the government, is a case study for affordable, low-energy living, including all sorts of pilot programs. DW's Hannah Lee Myers took a tour of Mariposa to find out more.
132 North had fired callers, state they were fighting one shot hurt.
The La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood in Denver, Colorado, had a reputation for pollution, poverty, and crime. But today, things are quite different.
This is the D line to 30th and Downing. Stand clear. The doors are closing.
Using cutting-edge and case-study green infrastructure, this neighborhood has been transformed into an award-winning, affordable housing community, now called the Mariposa District. And that name, Mariposa, has symbolic meaning.
The term Mariposa, butterfly, in Spanish, I think speaks a lot to the unique designs that they've brought into this neighborhood.
That's Region 8 Administrator Rick Garcia from the U.S. government's Department of Housing and Urban Development. Garcia explains that Mariposa was built with significant federal aid, starting with pollution cleanup by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
On the site itself, the EPA was involved, I think, early on in a cleanup of the site. Obviously, this location being adjacent to railroad tracks that had been used for freight and repair of large train engines for a number of years, it was necessary to do the kind of cleanup that would be needed before we could actually have this area be made available for people to live in.
Once the cleanup and well over 100 meetings with the community were complete, the Denver Housing Authority set to work building one of the most sustainable neighborhoods in the United States. And I was about to get a tour of all the best parts.
This is Ryan Tobin.
Ryan, nice to meet you. Yeah. Pleasure.
My guide, Ryan Tobin, Director of Development for the Denver Housing Authority, has dedicated the last 10 years of his life to making Mariposa as eco-friendly as possible.
This building has everything from a geothermal, a heat pump HVAC system, solar PV on the roof, gray water reuse systems in place, through the other things I mentioned, which are high efficiency controls and operational equipment within the building. So ultimately what we could say on this building is that it takes half the energy that a building built to this current code at its time would have actually been able to put out there. So, 50% energy reduction.
First, we visit a control room, housing Mariposa's case study gray water treatment system.
It's capturing water from like sinks and bathtubs and treating it and then either reusing it for irrigation and or in the toilets.
This control room also contains a part of Mariposa's geothermal system, a line of copper-colored pipes with handles and metal-numbered tags that pump water down into the ground, heating it up or cooling it down for domestic use.
This is designated right away. Anyway, so underneath this grill, this is another pilot program.
Outside, we walk over grates on the sidewalk that Tobin explains hold storm water during flooding, so the water can be treated before returning to the water system. What makes this stormwater system unique is that it's built right into usable space, opposed to monopolizing large chunks of usable land.
This into one of the townhomes?
Absolutely, yeah, they should all be unlocked.
Okay.
Inside one of the apartments, Tobin shows me how something as simple as installing a special gray light switch by the front door that turns off the flow of electricity to most of the outlets in the home can make it easy for residents to use less energy.
So this gray switch turns off every gray outlet in this unit. So if you leave your TV on or your lamps on, this is that last check out the door. I turn it off, everything but my alarm clock goes off. And you can see all the gray outlets throughout. So your appliances that would pull just energy by being plugged in, you're able to turn 90% of that down with just the flip of a single switch on your way out the door.
After seeing all these eco-friendly amenities, including Mariposa's newly completed multimodal transit hub, I wanted to hear from a resident what it's like living in an affordable housing community that looks like one of America's posh and almost futuristically new downtown districts. Joy McLean says considering Denver has some of the highest rental prices in the U.S., she's thrilled to be part of one of the first communities proving that sustainable living is economical.
Everything in here is green. Everything. The carpet, the floor, the appliances, the toilet, This floor is reprocessed corn. That's what this floor is made out of. These burners are energy efficient. Everything in here is energy efficient.
Near the end of my visit to Mariposa, sitting in Colorado's only residential interactive stairwell, featuring artwork and even museum-like educational buttons up the railing.
And here's a button for the Yucatan parrot.
Denver Housing Authority Intergovernmental and Community Affairs Officer, Stella Madrid, spoke about how Mariposa is proving to its low-income residents that building a stairwell like this one that discourages them from using an elevator and using green design to lower carbon pollution and cut long-term living costs are all related issues.
It's educating the community and the families who come into these new communities that in the long run, it's best for them, it's best for our community, it's best for the financial elements of it, and it's best for the environment.
With federal and private research showing that 2016 is poised to be a booming year for sustainable engineering in the U.S., and word getting out that green building technology has rapidly improved, individuals and businesses, with a variety of motivations, are expected to follow Mariposa's holistically sustainable example. For Living Planet, I'm Hanalee Myers.
Next, we meet a man who has taken sustainable living to another level. Nick Rosen is a campaigner, a filmmaker, and the author of a book called Off the Grid. He's changed his home and lifestyle in order to live off the grid, and he advises others to do just the same. So what does that entail, and what does going off the grid even mean? I put these questions to Nick.
Well, technically, it means living without mains power and mains water. So that means that you're running your own power station, although that might be a slightly grandiose way of talking about a couple of solar panels and a battery, but that is what you are doing in effect. You're running your own power supply, you're delivering your own water, whether that's by catching rainwater or going, having water delivered to you or by a borehole. You're dealing with your own waste because it's pretty unlikely that you're going to get garbage collections off the grid. And that means recycling, it means composting. You might be dealing with your own organic waste by having a composting toilet. All in all, it means that you're really in charge of and responsible for your own life, your own existence. It makes you much more aware of the world around you, nature, its processes. You become much closer to nature.
Now, say I want to go off the grid. What's involved? Can you walk us through the process sort of step by step and what infrastructure is needed for that?
Sure. Well, the first thing, obviously, you want is land and shelter, same as anybody else. But that might just be, you know, a little patch of somebody's back garden and a tent. Or it might be something far more elaborate. Then the next thing you need is light and heat, and that means power. That's likely to be solar, but it could be something as, you know, ecologically bad as a generator run on diesel. Who can say? I mean, if you're in Africa, it could easily be a diesel generator. At one point, before solar panels and wind turbines were easy to get, I was using my car battery as the main power supply. Then the next thing you need is water. So, as I said earlier, rainwater gathering is probably the best way to do it. You can catch rainwater from your roof into a large tank. Or if you're clever and lucky, you might be able to drill down into the earth below you and get the water that way. So that's power and water. And as I said, waste is the other issue that, you know, you're not going to be on the sewage system, so you're going to have to deal with that. Those are the three key elements.
Now tell us about the home you live in.
Well, I came across this subject, which I, you know, now spend so much time working on, by accident, really, because I was in Mallorca in a sort of millionaire's enclave called Dea and decided that I wanted to have a home there, but I couldn't afford it. It's, you know, full of huge villas, the views of the Mediterranean and olive groves. The only thing I could afford was a small shepherd's hut on a mountainside high up, and I bought it for about 10,000 euros, and then looking around for a way of charging my laptop, I found out about solar power, and I found out about living off-grid. So there I was, up the mountain, and then slowly I've added things. I've added an extra room with an outdoor kitchen, and from the roof of that room, I've added a huge water tank with about 40,000 litres of water, and I've even got a flushing toilet, because the water from the water tank goes down the hill to the toilet and flushes it into the septic tank. So it's a beautiful, ecologically complete little life I've got there now.
What is the difference? Like, how does an off-the-grid house differ to an on-the-grid house?
Well, you know, I get up at my place in Mallorca, and the first thing I do is check that the solar panels not got too much dust in it that might have come in via the rain overnight. So I give that a little bit of a wipe, make sure the sun's getting its power into my batteries. I might check the batteries to make sure they're in a healthy condition. I would make sure that the water from any rain is going into the tank, maybe not every day, but once every few days. I could easily switch on a light, but I would think twice about it and only do it if I needed it. And if I wanted to run the washing machine, I'd make sure that the sun was out and that I wasn't running any other power supply. So I'd be mindful of my power consumption. Then I'd make a coffee on the butane gas stove or possibly on a wood fire and sit outside and watch the view and drink my coffee in the morning.
Now, how much does it cost to go off the grid?
It's up to you. Again, you know, how elaborate do you want to be? But it's certainly less expensive than being on the grid for various reasons. One is the land is likely to be cheaper when it's off the grid because people value it less. You know, most people don't want that. Secondly, you become much more aware of your consumption. So as a result, you consume less energy, you consume less water. And also, when you're off the grid, you tend to make your building smaller because that way it doesn't cost so much to heat. So you end up following the, you know, the best environmental advice just naturally. So it costs you less to live off grid.
Now, as someone who rents and lives in the city, is it possible for me to go off the grid, or is it just limited to homeowners in the countryside?
It ought to be just the same story in the city as it is anywhere else. But the problem is governments, local governments, national governments, and the entrenched prejudices of other city dwellers who've paid £1 million for their penthouse and don't want you getting in on the cheap. The problem is what's called planning laws in England. It's called zoning laws in America. It's got different names all over the place. Some countries aren't so strict. Some states and counties in America are not so strict. But basically, the rule of thumb is anywhere that anybody would really want to live, it's really hard to live off-grid because of these laws. And this is especially true in Europe. You know, population is large and dense. It's very hard to find a patch of land in a city where you can just buy it and build yourself an off-grid home. That really should change. And but the only way I see that happening is in Brussels, at least the EU level, where the rights of people who want to live this way should, you know, could be respected and acknowledged, and then it could trickle down to national government from there.
Now, some skeptics would say that leaving the grid entirely doesn't make sense because not enough power can be generated in order to be independent. What do you say to that?
If you take the current levels of household consumption and general consumption of power and water, then they may appear to have a point. I'm not sure if they do, but it appears they might. However, when you go off the grid, your consumption drops to about 25% of what you were previously using. And at that level, it's perfectly plausible to run your own off-grid household. So the answer I would give is, it makes sense when you consider the way that people live now, but they wouldn't be living that way if they were off the grid. And actually, they don't need to live that way now. They've been encouraged to do so by advertising and almost a conspiracy among the producers of energy who want us to use energy as wastefully as possible. Don't forget, it was the energy companies that originally sold us all the consumer goods, fridges and cookers, and they were designed to use as much energy as possible. It's only in the last few years that the rules have come in to stop that happening.
And as someone who has successfully gone off the grid, do you have any words of wisdom or tips for others tempted by the idea?
Don't try and get it all right on day one. Expect that you can start slowly, you know, with just a couple of solar panels, for example. You don't have to have the entire system set up on day one. It didn't seem challenging at the time when I was doing it, but looking back on it, I'm quite surprised that I was able to pull it off. Don't try and do it on your own. It's not, unless you used to be in the Marines, you're just not going to have all the skills yourself. Because you're going to need to share resources, share skills, share land in order to be able to do this successfully. And it is quite challenging, and especially if you've got young children, it's definitely something you'd want to do as part of a community.
Well, there you have it. Some food for thought for those of you out there thinking of becoming eco-freaks yourself. That was Nick Rosen, founder of offgrid.com. And that wraps up the show for this week. For more episodes, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or simply visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Tune in again next week for another packed edition of Living Planet.
What would you do if it all came back to you? Each crest of each wave, bright as lightning. What would you say if you had to leave today? Leave everything behind, even though for once you're shining. Sounds you realize it's just a whim, and you notice it matters doing what you let under your skin. Good to the taste, would you sit back from a light of fire? Hold everything back, stand aside.